Well, some of us heard Jean-Luc Margot talk a couple of weeks ago or several weeks ago. And so you already know the punchline, you know, that Mercury has a molten core. Okay? And what I'm going to show you today is the details that led to that conclusion. And we think it's a fairly sound conclusion from what, with the information we have right now. I didn't make a nice introductory view graph, so let's start with this one. This is just a diagram showing Mercury's rotation, and I want to use it to define what I mean by some quantities. Mercury, as you know, rotates 1.5 times each orbit, so opposite poles, opposite sides are pointed towards the Sun at each perihelion passage. if it ends up with the long axis pointing toward the Sun at each perihelion, if the long axis is not pointed toward the Sun at the perihelion, there are torques averaged around the orbit which tend to restore it. So Mercury will have a free libration about the direction. If you take a stroboscope and point it and flash it each time it passes perihelion, you'll see it librate back and forth. And because the phase and amplitude of that libration is arbitrary, we call it a free libration. Okay? At the same time, the same torques which are acting on this averaged around give you the free libration, that libration period is about a period of 10 years or so. There is a forced libration due to the fact that you have reversing torques on the planet, because the planet keeps, you know, various aspects relative to the Sun as it goes around. This has the period of the orbit, and its phase is fixed and its amplitude is determined by the shape of the planet. This illustrates the free and forced librations. The forced librations are the high frequency, and the red curve is almost no free libration, and the green curve has a small free libration with the superposed forced librations on it. This is for a B minus A over C sub M, M being the mantle, 3.5 from 10 to the minus 4, and ABC are the ordinary principal moments of inertia. Right? And the condition is such that the Mercury spinning around its axis of maximum moment. And here's a close-up of the forced librations. These are deviations. The amplitude, the angle phi, is the deviation of the position, angular position of Mercury from the position it would have if it rotated absolutely uniformly. So this is the variation induced by these periodic torques. And this is the angular velocity, okay, it's over here. It's the angular velocity minus 1.5 n. So it's a deviation of the angular velocity from the mean, okay? And it's flat-topped up here at the periapse, perihelion, because Mercury's eccentricity is such, its orbital motion exceeds its rotational motion at that point. So the torque's reversed, and so it doesn't go up. And whereas the actual physical libration amplitude is almost sinusoidal, okay, the velocity deviates considerably from being a sinusoid. Mercury also has a unique condition for the spin position. If Mercury's orbit were fixed, okay, the spin, if it were deviated from the orbit normal, would precess around the orbit normal, like the Earth does. Okay, but Mercury's orbit precesses with a period of about 250,000 years. Regresses, actually, goes the other way. And so what that happens, it displaces the point of the precession off of the orbit normal to a point which we call a Cassini state, which is gets its name from the similar situation on our own moon, the Cassini states for the moon. And this is the condition where we displace it here about 1.6 arc minutes, consistent with the precession of 250,000 years. And in this case, the spin precesses around the Cassini state. Okay, And the tides and the coromantal dissipation will drive the spin to the Cassini state. Okay, so it'll be end up at this position right here. This line across here is the intersection of a plane with the unit sphere. That plane is determined by the orbit normal and the normal to the Laplacian plane. That's the plane which Earth, that Mercury maintains a constant inclination as it precesses. It's not the ecliptic, it's not the invariable plane. Okay, it's determined by the influence of the planets causing the precessions. The time constants for coromantal dissipation, this is for a viscosity, a viscous coupling of 0.01 centimeters squared per second, is about 200,000 years to damp the libration and about 100,000 years to damp the precession. So we'd expect Mercury to be located in those, its spin being right at the Cassini state and the free libration being damped to zero.
Okay, so the
excuse me? That 0.01, why that number? Okay, I'll show you the next one. This is how the time scales depend on the viscosity, and that thing was chosen 10 to the minus 2 because it's right in the middle of that assumed or estimated for the Earth's core. Okay, so it's just a sort of generic term of what the Earth's core would do. Now there's a important equation which I want to derive or point out here. The amplitude of the physical libration, that high frequency stuff which I showed you, depends on B minus A over C sub M. And I assume C sub M here to assume that the mantle is what's librating decoupled from the core. In other words, this measure of the liquid core depends on the idea that the physical libration will have a larger amplitude if the mantle is decoupled from the core than it would have if the mantle had to drag the whole planet along with it, okay? So you'll have a larger physical libration amplitude. This is B minus A over C sub N. From Cassini's law, see if you measure phi zero, if you measure that amplitude, then you have B minus A over C sub N, okay? From Cassini's laws, the origin of that, the deviation of that angle, that position of the Cassini state where we expect to find the spin, okay, is determined by the shape of the planet, okay, and C over mr squared. It's a response to a torque, okay, to give that angle, okay. And for the limit, in the case for the Cassini inclination, the Cassini obliquity being small, I get a measure, an expression for C over mr squared. And an important thing to notice here, it depends on the two lowest order of gravitational harmonics, coefficients, okay, as well as the inclination of the Cassini state, or the orbital, the obliquity of the Cassini state. If we measure the gravitational field harmonics, okay, then we have B minus A over mr squared, that's 4 times C22, okay, one of the gravitational harmonics. If we combine these factors down here, we get C sub M over C, okay, which will be less than or equal to 1. If it's 1, then the mantle is firmly coupled to the core. And if it's less than 1, the mantle is vibrating independent of the core. Okay. In order to determine this ratio, we need these four quantities, V0, J2, C22, and IC. And you see why, you know, where they come from. Yes? Excuse me? I don't know what you mean by true polar wander. You mean wander of the spin in inertial space? Or do you mean wander of the spin relative to the body axis? Body axis. That's just a Chandler wobble. Just a Chandler wobble, essentially. Okay. Well, the Chandler wobble should damp out. They should damp out on Mercury too. I'll bring that up I'll treat the Chandler wobble for Mercury in a minute when we get to the observations. Okay. There are conditions for the success of this experiment. Okay. Obviously, the liquid core must not follow the mantle during the 88 force libration period. Okay. On the other hand, the core must follow the mantle during the 250,000-year orbit precession. Okay. In order to have C in that case instead of some other thing. Okay. The B minus A, the difference in the equatorial moments of inertia, must be due to the mantle alone. Okay. And the adiabatic invariance must keep the spin close to the Cassini state during the slow variation of the orbital elements. It's the orbital elements to determine that position. Those things are changing because of the planetary perturbations. Okay. Now, without going into detail, we know that conditions 1 to 3, we've done these, looked at these, conditions 1 to 3 are satisfied for a viscous core-mantle coupling, okay? Topographical coupling due to core-mantle boundary conditions, okay, this is what Raymond Hyatt has proposed for the Earth. Magnetic coupling, those conditions are still satisfied. Gravitational coupling between axially asymmetric inner core and the outer core and the outer mantle. Okay, and finally, there being no convective cells in the mantle with horizontal scales greatly exceeding the mantle thickness. Okay, and I'll show why that is in a minute. The reason that is here, the B minus A must be due to the mantle alone. If there are convective cells with large horizontal scales, okay, they can lead to a core-mantle topography, which is long wavelength. And that means there can be much of this dense material in the mantle bulging up and contributing to B minus A. Okay? So you don't want that to happen. Now here's an example of the orbital variations. Take one of the variations, the inclination of the orbit. And this is relative to the ecliptic, and you see it goes all over the place, okay? And you can see the various time scales down here. You know, there's something like a million years and then a couple hundred thousand years and so forth, all those involved. So in order to check this adiabatic invariant, it turns out the adiabatic invariant is an action integral, as it usually is, and it deals with the solid angle swept out by the spin vector as it precesses around the Cassini state, okay? And yeah, it's moved. Okay, I want to move it up there. As it precesses around the scene, that is an adiabatic invariant. Okay, so it's an adiabatic invariant provided that the variations are slow enough. Okay, so what's slow enough? Okay, so I checked this. If the adiabatic invariant is satisfied, that means that if the spin is ever located near the Cassini state, which the dissipation is going to take it there, it'll hang around there because of this invariance as I slowly change the direction of the orbit normal relative to the sky. So in order to check this, I did the following. This d omega L to t, that's relative to the Laplacian plane. This xy plane is an initial Laplacian plane where you start, okay? And then I superpose a di dt on top of that, okay, which I'll let be periodic. And look at that. It's magic. It must be outgassing as it warms up. I superpose the di dt on top of that, that's directed along the intersection of the equator plane with the Laplacian plane, or the orbit plane, I'm sorry, with the Laplacian plane, okay? So I have a new vector motion of this orbit normal as a combination of the two. And what that does is that creates a new Laplacian plane. You're no longer with the same thing because both of these things are just moving in orbit normal. And all Mercury cares about is the orbit normal, where it is, okay? So by doing that, I can define a new Laplacian plane, calculate a new Cassini state, and see if the spin is still there with a periodic variation. And this is what happens. This is that same figure we had before, looking down on the unit sphere with the two things here. This is the Laplacian plane. This is the I cosine omega m, that's the position of Mercury's spin, the node of the Mercury spin, okay? And if I start out at the Cassini state, remember that was that one point, okay? And the Laplace plane normal and the orbit normal are way over there somewhere, okay? And then I slowly apply this kind of a perturbation with an initial inclination of 7.5 degrees plus 2.5 sine periodic term on it. And just ask what happens to the Cassini state. Calculating the Cassini state at each point, okay? These are the trajectories. This is relative to that original Laplacian plane, which is now no longer the Laplacian plane. But this is the Cassini state now, or the Cassini position. These dots are. In other words, if I take various periods, okay, even the shortest period, it gives this sort of motion. You see, it's a spin vector. That's what the red dots are. Is always close to the Cassini state, even for the very fast motions. So the adiabatic invariance seemed to be confirmed. You know that the thing, if it's ever there, it should stay there, and we should expect to find Mercury at that position. So the equilibrium configuration of Mercury is rotating at 1.5 each orbit, okay, with its spin close to the Cassini state, with free libration stamped to zero. Okay, that's what dissipation should carry us there, and adiabatic invariance will carry you there. No matter how I sort of randomly vary this position of the orbit normal, provided it's slow enough, and down to 100,000 years, it seems to be fine as far as preserving that. So in order to perform the experiment, we need...
I just want to ask, what's the other period? So this,
excuse me?
The 100,000 year was the...
That's the shortest one. Then the other ones were...
But what's the other period in the problem? It's the... You got a ratio of 2 times, which is
small. It's the precession period. That's 1,300 years, I'm sorry.
1,300.
Yeah, 1,000 to 1,300 years, depending on what you assume.
So it's still a ratio of 10 of 3 to 10 of 5.
That's right.
The 100.
Yeah. And it seemed to be slow enough. I mean, that ratio. We need precise determination for I sub C, phi 0, J 2, and C 2 for complete determination of C sub M over C. Okay? And we saw that why that was so earlier. There's two spacecraft going to Mercury. The Messenger spacecraft gets launched in May, May 11th in a 12-second interval at 2:35 a.m., which I learned this week. Messenger will determine all of these quantities, okay? And so will BepiColombo. And later on, I should probably give you a talk on the Messenger mission, because it is relevant to the origin of Mercury and planetary origin, okay, formation. But what I will devote the rest of the time to is radar, which can determine the obliquity and the physical libration. And from Jean-Luc's talk, you already know how that occurs. Okay, well, I'll describe that in more detail now. It's an interesting story how this radar picture came about. Now, this started from a Russian named Igor Holin. I got an email a couple years ago, out of the blue, saying Holin claimed he had a technique for measuring the position axis and the position of the spin axis of Mercury to a few arc seconds and to the physical libration to the same accuracy. So I said, well, I was skeptical, of course. I thought he was a nut. I says, would you send me, point out a paper, you know, where we can look this up and compare and look at the results? Well, the papers were in Russian. So he sent a Russian-English version of the paper to me. I couldn't really evaluate, the air analysis, the radar, so I sent it to Marty Slade at JPL, whom I knew was a radar astronomer. And Marty is old like I am and doesn't have any time, so he sent it to a young man, Jean-Luc Margot, who was over at JPL, at Caltech as a postdoc. And Jean-Luc looked at the analysis and thought it had merit and proposed to do the experiment, and the rest is history. Okay, and I'll describe what happened. Okay, Holin recognized, I had a demonstration for this, but I forgot to bring it. Holin, in his analysis, recognized if I shine a laser on the wall, okay, and I diffuse it so it's not a single spot, you know, I diffuse it out, the reflection comes back speckled. And that's because with the rough surface of the wall, you get constructive and destructive interference. And the pattern looks something like this, if you photograph it, okay? And there's a vast literature on speckles. You know, do the laser group, you know, laser literature, okay? And Holin recognized that a radar beam is very coherent radiation, okay? If you let it propagate for 10 minutes or something like that, and that impinging on Mercury's a rough surface, the reflection comes back speckled, okay? And he also realized that because the reflection is speckled, Mercury's rotating relative to the Earth. So what Holin showed was that the speckle pattern remains coherent for distances large compared to the size of the Earth, okay? So he proposed, let's have two antennas, okay, separated somewhat in longitude, and measure the reflected signal. You propagate a radar signal to Mercury for the time of flight and there back, which is like 10 minutes, 8 minutes or something like that, and then you listen with two antennas, okay? And then you do a cross-correlation of the signal between the two, okay? And you will only get a positive correlation if both antennas see the same speckles with the proper time delay between the two, okay? And that can only occur when the antenna baseline is aligned along the velocity vector of the speckle pattern as it's sweeping across the Earth, okay? And you can see with this, as the Earth is rotating around, you see how the antenna baseline rotates relative to the direction to Mercury, or relative to this velocity vector. Okay? And only at that instant, at that epoch, when the baseline of the antenna is parallel to the velocity vector, will you get a positive correlation with the proper time delay. Okay? At that instant, the baseline between the antennas and the direction to Mercury define a plane, which is perpendicular to the instantaneous component of the spin vector, which is perpendicular to your line of sight. Okay? If you do it twice, you have the spin vector in space. Okay? And the precision with which you can determine, well, first and next, the time delay between this point and this point for maximum correlation, that time delay gives you the instantaneous spin rate. And the precision with which you can determine both the direction to the spin of the spin and the spin period, or spin angular velocity at that time, depends on how well you can determine the maxima of these correlation functions, these cross correlations. And that turns out to be quite good indeed. Jean-Luc did this experiment in May and June of 2002 using the Green Bank antenna and the Goldstone radar. Goldstone did the propagation and listened both with Green Bank and Goldstone. Okay? It was successful the first time, and this is the correlation that he got, huge signal to noise, very well defined, only lasts a few tens of seconds, a couple tens of seconds, 20 seconds or so. And this defined the epoch of the, defined when the baseline was parallel to the velocity vector. And then the time delay looks even better. He fits a Gaussian to this distribution to determine the median point here. And it's determined about about a tenth of a millisecond, okay? The total time delay between the to get the correlation, the total time delay is about 12 seconds between the two. So with a tenth of a millisecond and a time of 12 seconds between the two, or 10, one can determine then the spin rate to 1 part in 10 to the 5th at that instant. Okay. And this was I got an exuberant email from Jean-Luc when this came through. He says, beautiful, with exclamation points, you know, that he got the correlation the first try. Incidentally, Jean-Luc got a phone call last night from Don Campbell telling him to call Joe Vavrika today to find the details of an offer. So he's got a job offer from Cornell. Okay. This is a superpose of the large ellipses are all of the data. We have 11 points. You know, you perform the experiment 11 times now. This series of air ellipses is the result of the first set of experiments, first four experiments. And this is the result of combining all of the experiments. And you see it's worse with more data. And the reason being is that the spin axis is not converging to the same point each time. Okay? And don't know why that is at the present time. Okay? The axes are elongated, the error bars are elongated, because it's less sensitive to motions of the spin axis in this direction, you know, along the line of sight. Okay? Very sensitive this way, but less sensitive that way, and that's why the distortion at error bars. So we're puzzled about this. We don't understand it. We can tell you something that it isn't. First thing you think of is a free wobble. And this is stuff I took out of a paper about the Earth, you know, these diagrams. Those are the standard free wobble diagrams. This one over here is the ordinary Chandler wobble, where the spin axis has a period in the Earth of about 430 days of traipsing around the axis of maximum moment. Okay. When you have that, you also get a slight wobble of the spin in space, which is what Jean-Luc measures. Okay. So this Chandler wobble case would be the one you try to look at. The period for Mercury, this is for a particular model of Mercury, of a rigid mantle with a homogeneous inviscid fluid core. And the core changes things from the rigid body case a bit. Okay, so it's a rigid mantle with this fluid core. In the process here, it reduces the period by a factor of two, so the precession period of the spin relative to the body axis is about 470 years. But the one Jean-Luc would see, if these things are real, you know, that variation in the spin axis is real, it has to be on a short period, you know, like the period of Mercury's spin or something like this. And we don't have enough data to really define what, you know, if there's any regularity in that motion or not. I may be wrong. It may be total. There may be some systematic error which is causing it. But this period, the period of the body axis, of the spin axis relative to the space around the angular momentum, is essentially the rotation period, 58.65 day period. Okay. And the angle, this angle of the cone of the spin axis relative to the angular momentum vector, which is fixed in space, this is for a free body, we ignore all other torques, is only this ratio, C minus A over A sub N, times the angle you would have the wobble angle, the Chandler wobble angle in the body axis. Okay? And if theta sub S was 0.2 arc minutes, that seemed to be the scatter that we saw, the wobble angle would have to be 10 degrees, which we find hard to believe, because the dissipation would have damped that in a fairly short time. Okay, there's another wobble which gives a wide angle of the spin in space and a small angle of the wobble angle in the body axes. Okay? And this is a nearly diurnal wobble which has not been detected, to my knowledge, for the Earth, in spite of the precise measurements now we have of the spin axis position. Okay? And this nearly diurnal wobble on this right figure, we'd have to look for not sigma b but sigma s, what the frequency of that motion is, and it's very tiny indeed. The period of that is 2300 years. So that's not it either. So we don't know what this means. But it's true. Here's that plane I defined for the normal, the intersection of the Laplacian plane with the unit sphere, and you see that the thing is close to being, if we're right at the Cassini state, the spin axis would be right on that line, okay? and it's off by a couple tenths of an arc minute. Okay, this amplitude here, the obliquity is about 1.7 arc minutes. It's always incredible to me to understand, to sit here on the Earth and measure the position of Mercury's spin axis to an arc minute, you know, and also to measure its spin rate to 1 part in 10 to the 5th. Now the really interesting thing is, and you've seen this plot before, this is the physical vibration. Remember, we could measure the spin period or the spin rate very precisely, 1 part in 10 to the 5th, each time we do the experiment. And these are the 11 points that we have, you know, spread out over time. The phase of this thing is determined. It's fixed. We know exactly what the phase of the physical vibration is. So the fact that these points fall on it is pretty good evidence that we're seeing the real physical vibration. Okay. This particular fit is a dynamic fit, okay, where we allow initial phase and initial angular velocity relative to the 1.5 rotation rate to exist, and they're all solved for. Okay. And these are the solutions that one gets with this least squares analysis with a fairly good chi-squared of 1.8. Okay. And this indicates, I mean, the values of this, of course, determine whether or not there's a free libration. And this slope implies that there is a slight free libration. One can't really say what the parameters are after, because we have about a year's worth of data, and only 11 points, and the free libration period's 10 years. Okay, so don't believe this free libration yet. Okay, at least it indicates it might exist. Right, but what this measurement gives you, the amplitude of this variation in the velocity, you see the flat tops as they go down, implies that B minus A over C sub M is 3.5 plus or minus 0.17 times 10 to the minus 4, okay, which is about 2 or 3 times bigger than we expected. That's bigger than we thought it would be. That value is very robust, because it doesn't matter how you reduce the data. We have the OC and SC refer to the opposite circular polarization and the same circular polarization. Normally, if you reflect off a perfectly reflecting surface with a radar beam, with a circular polarized beam, and you watch the electric vector turn, it's turning the same way as the thing comes back to you, but that's the opposite polarization. So that'll be the strong signal for a dielectric or a perfectly reflector. And we can do solutions for each one of those separately. And all of them come out to about 3.5 times 10 to the minus 4. With no free libration, the chi-squared is not so great. So that's the one parameter fit. Then we can add an offset, then an offset with a slope. So this is a two-parameter fit, it gets better. A three-parameter fit, it gets even better. And this is a dynamical fit, which I showed you, which has a chi-squared of 1.5 to 1.7. But it doesn't matter how we reduce the data, it all looks the same as far as B minus A over C sub M. So I repeated the equation, the determining equation above, and we have values for J2 and C22 from the Mariner spacecraft that flew by, had three passes of Mercury, and two of those were used to determine J2 and C22. And they're not determined very well, 50% error in C22 and 30% error in J2, okay? But these are the values we have from Anderson et al., okay? And from Margot et al. In 2002, we have a measure of the inclination of the Cassini state of 1.7 arc minutes, plus or minus 0.2. Okay? If we plug these three values into that equation, which I showed you for C over mR squared, these are the ranges of C over mR squared that one gets. The empirical bounds on C over mR squared are meaningless. Okay? But we can do better than that, because we know that Mercury is not hollow. Okay, have C over mR squared this big, and we know its core is not made of uranium. Okay, so we have a series of models, exhaustive series of models, 50 or 1,000 or something like this, by Harder and Schubert, where they varied the sulfur content of Mercury's core. Okay? And why that's important is the sulfur content, if I increase the sulfur content, I decrease the melting temperature. Okay, all the way down to eutectic at some fairly good dose of sulfur. And their constraints on C over mR squared theoretically are from 0.325 to 0.380. Okay? Now, I can go back to this equation up at the top and distribute I have a measure of B minus A over C sub M with an error bar. Okay? I have a measure of B minus A over mR squared with an error bar. That's this one. Okay? I can distribute those normally and let the error bar be the standard deviation. For C over mR squared, I can choose any value in between here. I can choose the extremes, or I can uniformly distribute it. Okay? Then do a Monte Carlo check of several hundred thousand points and evaluate what the values of C sub M over C would be, what its distribution would be. And this is what happens. These are three extremes, C over mR squared at 0.380, and this is the other extreme, 0.325. Up here, C over mR squared is uniformly distributed between those two values. Okay, and these are the distributions of C sub M over C that we get. The means are given here, about 3.34 to about 0.38 or so, and with fairly small standard deviations. Okay. The values chosen for the uniform distribution down here, B minus A over C sub M, slightly different than the 3.5, but this was consistent with one of the other solutions. The B minus A over mR squared comes from the C22 that Anderson measured. Okay, 4 plus or minus 2 times 10 to the minus 5. These are the standard deviations used. And then this C over mR squared was uniformly distributed between those two. Okay, and all of them lead to C sub M over C considerably less than a half. Okay. So what are the conclusions? Okay. The value of B minus A over C sub M of 3 to 4 times 10 to the minus 4 obtained from the radar speckle differential interferometry is reasonably robust. So no matter how we reduce the data, we've got a value close to that. The data show evidence for a free libration. Because of the period of such libration is 10 years, additional data are required to characterize the free libration component. The theoretical bounds on C over mR squared still provide better constraints than those available empirically. Remember the big wide band we got for the empirical constraints. Okay. But that will change when messenger orbits Mercury, because we'll get those values of C22 and C20, or J2, when we get the gravitational field from Mariner, from messenger. Okay. C sub M over C is less than 0.7 with 95% confidence with those distributions that we had, okay? No matter what we choose for C over mR squared. And remember, it was the obliquity that we had to have in order to get C over mR squared, as well as those other two quantities of C22 and C20. And the precise value of C sub M over C requires a determination of C over mR squared. So we have to have the messenger data, or the Bepi-Colombo data, or both, in order to evaluate what the actual size of the core is. But the current best values of, and uncertainties in, B minus A over C sub M, B minus A over mR squared, and C over mR squared imply that all of Mercury does not participate in the forced librations of the mantle. Okay? Otherwise, that C sub M over C would have been way up there, close to 1. And the only way we know how to explain C sub M over C less than 0.7 is for the mantle to be decoupled from the interior by a molten layer. Okay? And that's really a coup for Jean-Luc. You know, I mean, here's a young man who's made this major discovery in one of his early experiments. So I think Cornell really got a gem. So that's it. Oh, great. Question? Excuse me? Why doesn't it? It does. That's what motivated all this stuff. It does, yes. The Mariner flyby found a dipole. Well, it's consistent with a dipole field. We don't know whether the components are there. But the only way that we could think of making it a dipole, a field, you know, an intrinsic magnetic field of Mercury, was with a dynamo which required molten conducting fluid moving around, relative, you know, conducting in the interior. And so that motivated the whole idea of looking for a molten core. Now, maybe the case that Mercury's field is not due to a dynamo. There may be other, you know, exotic crustal remnant magnetism from a former field. And that was thought to be far too small until we went to Mars. And we found these huge, high magnified surface layers, okay? Now you say, well, Mars is special. It's full of iron. The surface is full of iron. There's been no iron detected on the surface of Mercury in any spectral analysis that we know of. But anyway, it's still, and there was a theorem by Runcorn that said, if I have a uniformly magnetized shell with a dipole field, and I shut off the field, that the remnant magnetism will lead to no external field. Okay? If I punch that with a crater, of course, that destroys the magnetism there or changes it to something else, then I'll start seeing external effects. And there is an effect on Mercury, and there's been a paper published by Odette Aronson as the first author of looking at the possibilities that Mercury has two hot poles. Remember, it's one pole or the other, one point on the equator or the opposite point on the equator that were heated each time it came around toward the sun. Those might indicate, raise the temperature above the Curie point and destroy the magnetism at those points and preserve it elsewhere, and it would lead to an external field that you could see. It's probably unlikely. So the most likely source of the field is a dynamo. The MESSENGER mission has a magnetometer on it, and it will measure the details of the magnetic field. It's not exactly trivial because you have to sort out the effect of the solar field and the solar wind. You have to sort that out from what the planet is. And they use particle detectors and all kinds of detectors on the machine. It's quite a sophisticated spacecraft. And I'll tell you about that sometime later. But it will determine, what the nature of the field is. There's become a cottage industry in looking at the generation of magnetic fields in shells, relatively thin shells of molten material, which is unlike the Earth, where the central core is fairly tiny compared to the whole volume of the core. In Mercury, that's not true. The solid inner core could be quite large, depending on what the sulfur content is, so how much of it is solidified. And I've forgotten his last name, Jonathan at UCLA, and Sabina, who is a student of somebody in Harvard, I've forgotten, are both doing calculations, looking at the effects from first principles, like the Glatzmar calculations for the Earth, using from first principles, generating the fields that you expect to see how they would be distinguished from, a field that's generated in the Earth. And so that's the cottage industry, which is starting up. And I heard papers by both of these people just the day before yesterday, in fact. It was quite interesting.
Is there actually any constraint
on whether
it's a solid core?
Excuse me? There would be no solid core if Mercury's sulfur content was near the eutectic. And these are models of Schubert et al. Because it lowers the eutectic is the minimum temperature you can lower it to. And if it's at that level, the models of Schubert et al. Claim you could get, no solid core. But as the amount of sulfur is reduced, okay, then the size of the inner core grows because it will have solidified. The melting temperature is higher. And we had a big discussion last time when John Milk gave his talk, is how mercury got its sulfur. You know, because it's a volatile and that's close to the sun. And years ago, when you believed John Lewis, you thought, well, there's no way you could have sulfur that close to the sun. If you can, if you make mercury out of the material that condensed it at that point in the solar nebula. On the other hand, later calculations, these in-body calculations, showing that the inner solar system is quite mixed. And so you have material brought completely out of and be parts of mercury. So there's, in my opinion, there's no worry about having sulfur in mercury. We don't know how much, but it certainly could have volatile things there. Excuse me? Excuse me?
Where would you put the sulfur line? Well, outside where mercury forms.
Yeah.
That's what you said.
Yeah, I don't know, mercury's melted at 100 C or something like that, so it must be volatile at a 200 C. And wherever that point occurred in the solar nebula occurred would be the sulfur line. The water line's out by Jupiter, the sulfur line's of course farther in.
I thought it was around 700.
Is it that high? Kelvin, that would be, that'd be 300 C or so. 400 C. I don't know. It's I don't know where it is.
Well, our models of the temperature structure is going over the volume.
Yes.
It might not be necessary.
Any other questions? We can measure that optically. You can optically measure that. It turns out there is a physical vibration. Don't know how it's excited, and it's fairly a very very small amplitude, of course. But there was a controversy for a number of years that Daryl Mulholland a number of years ago hypothesized a physical vibration from lunar laser ranging data. That's the precision that you need. But Jim Williams, who's much more conservative, would not accept it for years and years until enough data came that supported it. But apparently there is a small physical vibration of the moon. I don't think it's not big enough to indicate any kind of molten core. Anyway, most of the moon, because we have seismology measurements, and so most of the moon is solid. They maybe have a small molten core, but not very big.
How about the situation with Mars, since we now have transmitters up there?
I don't know about Mars. Don't know. Jean-Luc can turn his radar on Mars, too. He's already got data for Venus. And this technique is see, we can watch the rotation of Venus now as a function of time. We can watch the rotation of Mercury now as a function of time, providing you can get enough time on the antennas, telescopes. You can start measuring the interchange of angular momentum between Venus's core and its mantle, just like we do on the Earth, and interchange between the atmosphere and the planet, if such occurs. Okay? And I don't know if it's... It's quite exciting. It's really a geophysical tool. It's here.
Good talk, Stan.
Thank you. I always manage to shuffle these view graphs.
Yes,
you know?
So do I. That always happens. But that's the advantage of having it on the computer.
Right? Having it on the computer, yes. They always stay in order. They always stay in order.
Except they don't project, but that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, the one disadvantage of the computer I found, it's often I cut and paste. I'll take a figure out of some book, and how will I do that on the computer? I mean, I have to scan it and then put it in there, and it becomes a real pain.
I know.
Where these are trivial to do here. It's easy.
So I was wondering, I didn't catch this, maybe you said it, so having these radars sort of on this line, were they already there, or did you...
Well, the radars exist. No, the radars exist. But I mean, the antennas exist.
Yeah, but do they have to be moved?
Oh, no, you can't move them. You can't move these big telescopes.
So did they have to be built specifically for this purpose, or had to wait until they were in the line?
No, you wait. See that picture I showed with the Earth? And with as it rotates around. No, you choose, I mean, there are many, many pairs of antennas.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, not very many radars. Yeah. There's Arecibo, there's Goldstone, there's maybe one in Europe or Russia or something like that. Yeah. There aren't very many of those.
Yeah.
But relative to those, there are many other radio and many other radio telescopes that you can combine for possible baselines. And you can choose, you choose a baseline, you can tell when it's going to be in the approximate alignment, that it'll be so you know approximately where it's going to be, because you know approximately where the spin axis is going to be. So you have to take data for something like, you have to propagate the radar at the right time, and you know when to do that. You know when to
So
just as you pick a time, sometime during that time, the antenna baseline you know is going to go through that velocity vector.
So one of the radio dishes just collects the radar from the other instrument.
Well, see, they both listen. Only one transmits.
Okay.
And I don't know whether you remember in the physical vibration diagram which I showed, the error bar is sitting over on the far side. The last set of points was much bigger than the other error bars.
Yeah.
The reason was that was Arecibo used as the transmitter. Arecibo does not have an X-band transmitter. It was S-band, 70 centimeters or something versus, or 13 centimeters versus 3.5 centimeters. That makes the speckles bigger. And the speckles bigger, then you can define less accurately where the correlation occurs because it occurs over a wider area because the speckles are bigger. And that's why those air bars are less. So I suggested to John that next time he uses Goldstone and Arecibo, he lets Goldstone do the transmitting, Because Arecibo may only have a rudimentary receiver at 3.5 centimeters. I don't know that. Because, it's just recently that the surface has been refined to the point where it was good at less than 10 centimeters. Because they've done a, when it was first put up, it was just a netting, so it was awful. And I think they couldn't use nothing shorter than 70 centimeters. But now they've refined it, tied it down, and put a metal surface on it now, so it's really pretty accurate now. But it may not quite good enough for 3.5 centimeters yet, I don't know.